Great. Well, thank you for joining our Financial Services Teleconference Series, Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. Today's session is an update on the CARES Act and legislative developments. My name is Mike Nanaka, and I'm an attorney in the Financial Services Group at Covington. I work on a variety of regulatory, compliance, transactional, and policy matters for banks and other financial institutions. I'm joined here today by Laith Al-Hassani, who practices in the firm's Public Policy Group. He most recently served as Special Assistant to President Obama in the White House Office of Legislative Affairs from 2012 to 2015. This is the 14th session in our weekly series. We've had sessions covering just about every financial services regulatory enforcement, litigation, and transactional topic, and there's still one remaining presentation. So next week, Gene Vita, Nick Hilgore, and Graves Lee will give a presentation to assist financial institutions in preparing for the oversight and enforcement mechanisms relating to the coronavirus response. We're very excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients. It's been a lot of fun putting these on and planning them. And before we get started, I have just a few housekeeping items to mention. For those interested in CLE credit, today's program is approved for a half credit in New York and California. Embedded in the meeting confirmation notice that you should have received yesterday is a link for participants to download a remote attendee affirmation form and evaluation form. Folks will need to complete the remote attendee form, including with the affirmation code that I share towards the end of the call, and then return the form to our colleague, Al McManus. His information is on the form, and then Al will come back to you with a certificate of attendance in short order. We also would welcome any questions that you may have during the program. If you have one, please go ahead and send it along to Al. His email address is amcmanus@cov.com. We'll try to answer as many questions as possible, but of course we'd be pleased to connect with you on an individual basis offline after the presentation. So with that, I think we can get started. The CARES Act was signed into law on March 27, 2020, and boy, did that seem like several lifetimes ago at this point. When the act was passed, terms like PPP for Payroll Protection Program, Main Street Lending Program, and Section 4003 were just not the household names that they are today. And since that day, Laith and I have ridden the roller coaster that comes along with that legislation that was developed very quickly in response to the pandemic and that required implementation that had to be done even faster. There were many hiccups in CARES Act implementation, starting with the initial rollout of the SBA's PPP and then continuing into other programs as well. But I think it's fair to say that much of the CARES Act at this point would be deemed a success based on different short-term economic indicators, while other areas would be assigned probably an incomplete grade just because they haven't been fully deployed. I'm going to provide a status update on various terms in the CARES Act and what's potentially still to come in the way of relief. And with that said, with even fairly substantial sums of funds under the Act having not yet been deployed, it's noteworthy that Congress and the administration are now considering additional stimulus legislation that Laith will cover in greater detail. We'll also discuss some of the priorities of congressional administration leaders for that next round. Now, all of that is to say that we're providing an update on pretty dynamic subjects that change often, change quickly. The update webinar that we could do in 2 or 3 months would probably demonstrate a lot of that movement and progress, just given the potential for various economic, legislative, and regulatory developments. My summary is going to fall within or cover three different buckets, the first being the SBA PPP. Second, I'll cover the Treasury Direct Loan and Payroll Support Programs under Title IV of the CARES Act, and then close with the Federal Reserve's funding facilities, like the Main Street Lending Program and Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility. So the SBA's PPP provided forgivable loans through banks and non-bank lenders to certain small businesses to be used to pay payroll costs and benefits. You've no doubt heard of it by now. It's in the news regularly. The initial tranche of PPP funding, if you rewind to April, some $349 billion was completely exhausted in the middle of April, only days after it had been started by the SBA. But given its popularity and I think usability by small businesses, Congress authorized an additional $310 billion in funding with certain amounts earmarked to be used by smaller lenders to kind of make sure that there's diversity in lending in terms of who are actually participating in the program as lenders. A program officially closed just yesterday, with some reports indicating that the SBA had approximately $100 billion in funds remaining, I think demonstrating that the funds were necessary. But that said, late last night, the Senate passed legislation that would extend the PPP to August 8th. That still requires House action in order for it to be passed out of Congress. So it still does live on to some extent. That said, if it were to end, nearly 4.8 million PPP loans were made by banks and non-bank lenders, totaling over $519 billion. The average loan size was just $108,000, and the majority of loans were for less than $50,000. And I think that rebuts some of the early reports that we heard that the PPP would be used by large corporations that weren't in need of the money, and that's just not the case. I think the PPP, going back to the point that I made earlier, exemplifies some of the diversity of the financial services sector in the U.S. You had large banks like JPMC, Bank of America, PNC, and Truist making the most loans in terms of dollars extended, while small community banks like Cross River made substantial number of loans, and then other non-bank lenders that had a bespoke process to be qualified as SBA lenders that came together very quickly in April. Lenders like PayPal, Intuit, Cabbage, and OnDeck were approved to make PPP loans, and they made a lot of loans with smaller amounts to small businesses, independent contractors in need. The PPP story is far from over, even if the program may have ended yesterday, subject to what the Senate did. You certainly will continue to hear about it. There's a lot of discussion now about a key element of the program relating to forgiveness. So there are certain criteria that need to be satisfied in order for a loan to be forgiven by the SBA, and obviously borrowers, lenders alike, very interested in that. And forgiveness was, and I think continues to be, difficult operationally in terms of the different criteria that need to be satisfied. Congress passed legislation that lowered some of the hurdles for forgiveness, intended to make it easier, but it's still a challenging issue. And to that point, the American Banker reported yesterday that a lot of banks were seeking to sell their PPP loans or outsource the forgiveness function to third parties based on those challenges. And then another reason why it's not going away anytime soon relates to enforcement. I'm not going to stomp on the great presentation that our colleagues are going to give next week, but suffice it to say, PPP is a major focal point for enforcement and investigations. The CARES Act establishes a slew of oversight mechanisms and bodies charged with uncovering fraud and illegality. So even though the program has a pretty limited life, I think it's going to continue to reverberate within the industry for months or even years to come. The next area to cover is the direct loan programs established in Title IV of the CARES Act, and then the related payroll support program that I'll actually cover first. That's payroll support, not to be confused with the PPP, even though it very frequently is. The payroll support program is a grant program that's designed specifically for passenger air carriers, cargo air carriers, and then contractors that provide services to air carriers on site at airports. It provides funds to approximately 6 months worth of payroll, excluding certain employees, to be used by air carriers and contractors for paying employee wages, salaries, and benefits. There was an application process that was administered by Treasury and its advisors in April. The deadlines have passed, although Treasury has the discretion to award funds subject to there actually being funds available. The CARES Act website that Treasury maintains has a database of all the recipients of payroll support funds. Just a few interesting wrinkles about the program. The program is structured and kind of advertised as a grant, but Treasury decided for certain applicants to disperse part of the proceeds as a loan to the extent that the proceeds exceeded a certain amount. And the CARES Act also authorizes Treasury to receive a warrant or other financial instrument in connection with the program. And for those applicants that received payroll support in excess of a certain threshold, Treasury received warrants or a senior unsecured note on top of the payroll support. The payroll support program, unlike the PPP and unlike Main Street, doesn't have employee size limitations. So companies of all sizes, all ownership structures, were eligible to obtain assistance, assuming they met other criteria. But the hallmark of the Title IV program that Treasury administers is a direct loan program under Section 4003. That section authorizes Treasury to make direct loans to industries that Congress determined were particularly affected by the pandemic. So it authorized $25 billion to passenger air carriers, certified repair station operators, and ticket agents, and then another $4 billion to cargo air carriers, and then finally $17 billion to companies that are critical to national security. There was also a loan application process that Treasury administered in April. The final date for national security companies was May 1st. And interestingly, as far as we are aware, Treasury had not made a loan under this program until announcing one this morning that it had made to a company, YRC Worldwide, that it determined to be critical to national security. Treasury has been very deliberate in conducting legal and financial due diligence to confirm eligibility. So this is an example of a program that very much has a grade of incomplete. We're going to have to see how the program unfolds to get a better sense of its effectiveness, but that'll play out in the coming weeks and coming months. And then finally, I wanted to cover the Federal Reserve funding facilities under Title IV of the CARES Act and just give an update on them. On the one hand, it's somewhat misleading to call them CARES Act programs, at least all of them CARES Act programs, because many of them were first rolled out during the financial crisis in 08 and 09. Even from some of the newer programs, many of them were announced by the Federal Reserve prior to passage of the CARES Act. But it is the case that they do rely to some extent on CARES Act funding, so it is accurate in that sense. On April 9th, 2020, the Fed unveiled the majority of these programs when it announced that it would come up with facilities that would provide up to $2.3 trillion in loans to support the economy. The programs included the Main Street Lending Program, the Paycheck Protection Program Liquidity Facility, the Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility and Secondary Market Corporate Credit Facility, the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, or TALF, and the Municipal Liquidity Facility. Like many Federal Reserve programs, their acronyms galore with the different lending facilities. And at the time, in early April, the Federal Reserve put out two or three page term sheets for all of these facilities with the promise of more information to come. And then since early April, when our colleague Jeremy Newell described all of these programs as well, they've released additional information in piecemeal fashion about these different programs. So each of them has their own objective. They make credit available in different ways or to different types of borrowers. The programs do rely to some extent on the Federal Reserve's emergency lending authority, rather, under 13.3 of the Federal Reserve Act. And what that means is that for participants in the programs, the borrowers will be subject not only to the CARES Act restrictions, which can be very onerous, but also to the restrictions in Section 13.3 itself. And that has resulted in a lot of the certifications and standardized documentation that the Federal Reserve has released in connection with the programs being fairly lengthy and detailed as to those specific requirements. All of these facilities, with a minor exception at this point for the Municipal Liquidity Facility, which is designed for states, counties, and cities, all these facilities are live and operational. That said, the Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility just went live 2 days ago on Monday this week. The Federal Reserve's Main Street Lending Program became operational only 2 weeks ago. So the grade for these facilities also is incomplete. It's worth highlighting two of these facilities for various reasons. The one that I'd start with is the Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility. That is going to be used by the Federal Reserve to purchase newly issued corporate bonds and portions of syndicated loans and bonds. And then the close sibling of that, the Secondary Market Corporate Credit Facility, will be used to purchase those same assets, but also U.S.-listed exchange-traded funds, as well as certain other assets. The secondary market version became operational in early May, and the primary market version came operational just this week. There are a lot of certifications released earlier this week that are still being digested, but that program is interesting because it was not used during the financial crisis in 2008, but will be used to purchase investment-grade bonds from potentially large corporate issuers. And then finally, the Main Street Lending Program is worth drilling down into a bit more as well, because it's often been championed as the hallmark, activity or response to the pandemic by a number of analysts. It's going to provide loans through regulated banks to small and mid-sized businesses, businesses that are potentially larger than those that could have qualified for PPP funding. The loans are not forgivable, but the Federal Reserve will purchase a participation in the loan, a large participation, 95%, from the bank lender. There are fairly generous repayment terms and pricing terms, and it will be interesting to see how many lenders participate in that program. For all of those Federal Reserve facilities, I think we need to see the level of bank participation in the program, especially for Main Street, and also the borrower participation across all the programs, just to know how they're going to be used, whether they're going to be effective. It has taken some time, and the Federal Reserve has caught some flack for that, but now that they've all been deployed, I think we have to pay close attention to different economic indicators to see exactly what happens. And by a lot of counts, programs like Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility and the TALF, which already have had an impact, you would call that at least a short-term success. Also, the Federal Reserve is not necessarily done. It could come out with additional facilities in the months ahead. So with that, just before I turn it over to Leith, it's worth mentioning that based on Secretary Mnuchin's testimony and Chairman Powell's testimony of this week, the economic effects of the pandemic haven't been fully realized, so it's a bit early to judge these facilities. With the potential for second waves of the pandemic, other causes, there could be massive uptake in these programs months down the road in a way that we just don't foresee right now. So I think the only thing to say is stay tuned. It's not yet time to exit the roller coaster. We're still going to be on it. So at this point, let me turn it over to Leith, and I think for him to go over what everyone has been waiting for, what's coming from Congress, what's coming in the future. So, Leith?
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. And, obviously, you guys, please do feel free to, ask any questions by email to Al McManus at the email address that Mike shared at the top of the hour. Thanks for the opportunity to address you guys on where Congress is headed now that Mike sort of filled us in on the CARES Act. The sort of million-dollar question, trillion-dollar question is, will there be a sequel to the CARES Act? And if so, when will that happen and what will be in it? And I think in terms of when, will there be? I mean, I think, it's fair to say that all of the major potential negotiators have signaled willingness to look at another package. Some are more aggressive about that than others, but it appears that we will probably get one more package before the election. That package very likely will see the light of day starting around the week of July 20th, and that provides about 3 weeks for Congress to negotiate with the administration and one another. And so I think your sort of bookends that sit in front of the month-long August recess are from July 20th to August 8th for activity. And I think you would certainly expect that if the deal comes to fruition, it would happen in the second half of that window. So we're looking at the tail end of July and the first week of August. As Mike mentioned, PPP has been extended for 5 weeks to August 8th by the Senate, and I don't think that date was an accident. That certainly appears to be the back end of this process. And if it's not done by August 8th, the members will go back home for a month, and there is time when they get back in September before they break for the election. We'll have had, virtual conventions, and clearly it will be very difficult to get major legislation done if they're not able to get it done by the August recess. I think when we think about the next potential COVID package, you can start with what the House Democrats passed already, which is the HEROES Act, a $3 trillion bill that really only represents minimal amount of negotiation with the Republicans. This was a House Democratic-led effort. The House Democratic leadership and the committee chairman of the major committees that have, have a piece of the COVID issue really designed it as a little bit of a starting point for negotiations. $3 trillion bill, focused on state and local governments, which is a big priority for Democrats on the Hill, with healthcare and, you know, contact tracing provisions in it. They made one interesting decision to expand the employee retention tax credit. This is something that appeared in the CARES Act in a minor way as a little bit of an accompaniment to the PPP program for companies that have experienced, you know, turmoil because of COVID. The HEROES Act took what was in CARES and made it more generous, but at the same time, leadership declined to really make it a lot more generous, which would clearly have, you know, been a bit of a game changer. If you think about the CARES Act structuring, you know, Democratic priorities around unemployment for gig workers and the self-employed and an additional unemployment payment, bipartisan support for PPP, those are two very expensive items that represent the priorities of the parties. The employee retention tax credit may be a bit of an afterthought in CARES, but there are a lot of proposals floating around the Hill right now that, you know, could represent Congress and the administration changing its focus somewhat from PPP and from unemployment to this payroll guarantee, if you will, that, you know, takes a company's payroll and allows the company to, you know, keep its payroll intact through the IRS in the form of a credit. And if that, you know, if that takes off in a big way, it'll have a big score with it in the negotiations of the parties. And, you know, the discussions around maybe the $3 trillion House HEROES Act getting whittled down to more like $1 trillion or somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion, you know, definitely if they go in the direction of an ERTC, Employee Retention Tax Credit expansion, they're gobbling up a lot of the score. You could easily have a score in the $600-800 billion range if they were to go in that direction. You know, so I think that the obvious impetus for another bill will also be because Senate Republican leadership decides they want one. And that decision is not firmly made at this point. I think Leader McConnell has essentially said, you know, we will, you know, do it if one is necessary. And if one is necessary, we will definitely want liability immunity in it. Leader McConnell has made that his biggest priority. He assigned Senator Cornyn from Texas to work on this. What we believe is that, you know, the Republicans in the Senate probably are very close to having a proposal ready for primetime, but they're probably unlikely to share it with the public during this July 4th recess period that we have coming, and instead to sort of hold it back and roll it out when they come back on the week of the 20th. We don't think the Democrats have had any input at all. There have been some hearings in the Senate Judiciary and Senate Help Committees on the topic, so we can say some things about it. But clearly, you know, some sort of temporary liability immunity that is focused around COVID is probably going to be in Leader McConnell's proposal, and it'll probably receive very stiff opposition from Democrats. This is not an unusual, you know, if you look over time, not so unusual to see significant tort reform proposals come out in an election year, and they tend to be partisan, and usually they don't go anywhere. But, you know, obviously we have unusual circumstances here, and this is clearly the kind of entry ticket for McConnell's, you know, effort in this area. And Democrats may have a hard decision around whether to, you know, make a compromise around liability immunity. The Senate Republicans, I'd say their other priority is delay. I think partly they want to let the economy play out, see how CARES is functioning after the July 4th recess. But also I think delay, you know, it enables them to make sure there's only going to be one more package before the election. I think had they really, you know, sort of sped one out the door after the House passed HEROES, there could have been some chance that there'd be a second package, and I don't think that's what they wanted. So, you know, that's, I would say that is another priority. The other thing to mention is whether there'll be a distressed industries section in the bill. This is something that's been talked about since before CARES. Distressed industries like restaurants and, you know, hotels, others, were not addressed directly in CARES. Mike talked about how aviation and aviation-related industries were to some degree, they could see some further relief as well. And there are some proposals floating around Congress that would kind of focus on one industry or another. So that's a possibility. Senate Democrats, very much want a bill, want state and local assistance to be in it, and want some form of unemployment extension. The unemployment provisions in the CARES Act expire at the end of July. So that's not an accident either. And it would be a forcing mechanism, I think, for Democrats to come to the table. The administration has said they want a payroll tax credit. They have expressed interest in, capital tax relief. It appears that a tax title is going to be in the next package, that the House had one. I think the tax writing committees on the Hill believe they're going to be negotiating at the end of July on a tax title. So obviously, once a couple provisions tax-related end up in a bill like this, there can be a bit of a snowball effect, and you could see, broader tax relief and other provisions of interest to various sectors. The last thing I guess I'd say is, we have an election. The other administration priority is getting reelected. And certainly, the president can spur activity among Senate Republican leadership if he decides that a bill would work for him more quickly, or a bigger bill, certain provisions in it that maybe he hasn't pushed up to this point. It's clear that the electoral situation is fluid and that the president has had a difficult June. And I would expect that that will affect what the administration wants and when it wants it for this next COVID package. Some people would say that broadband and other infrastructure provisions may be a forcing mechanism also for the next COVID package, and I think that's possible. Broadband has bipartisan support, and if broadband gets in there, then I think you could see other infrastructure provisions right along with it. But that'll be something negotiated among the parties probably when they get back from July recess. At this point, I think I'll stop and. We appreciate the opportunity to brief you guys on this one, and happy to take questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Leith. I think there's a lot to look forward to in the way of regulatory and legislative developments. For those interested in CLE credit, I'm going to read the code that I mentioned at the top of the hour, and this is the code that you have to include in the remote attendee affirmation form, and they always tell us that capitalization matters, so I will do the same. So the code is 4 characters, and it is lowercase s, 6, uppercase r, lowercase d. And let me read that one more time. It's lowercase s, 6, uppercase r, lowercase d. We do hope that you found the session to be valuable, and that you'll join us next week when Gene, Nickel, and Graves talk about preparation for litigation and enforcement relating to the coronavirus response. They're going to describe measures that banks are taking to ensure appropriate readiness through the current economic slowdown. You can find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website, which is www.cov.com, and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Links to both are included in the meeting materials. Again, thank you for joining us today. We didn't receive questions during the call, but certainly if you do have any after the fact, please don't hesitate to reach out to either Leith or myself. Thank you very much.